For Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The incumbent mayor of Salisbury, Jake Day, has a challenger this election. His name is Wayne King. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. King describes himself as a 51-year-old conservative Republican. His past experience includes owning a business for some 20 years before selling it about 6 years ago. 4 years ago, he moved to Salisbury. His website includes issues ranging from revitalization of downtown and crime to economic development and transparency in government. And he joins us this morning in the studio. Welcome to the program.
How you doing there, Don?
So, give me your sense about the vision that you have for this city if you were elected mayor.
If I was elected mayor, I would like it to be a thriving metropolis. We do have one issue, though. We're the second most dangerous cities in Maryland, and I think we need to clean up the crime a little bit before any major businesses are going to want to come here. One thing that is kind of interesting is he is building a 13-story high-rise. A lot of the citizens don't agree with it. Some of it because of the skyline, some because of the historical factor of the city. But basically, I think it could be a good thing if he doesn't turn it into apartments, because I believe we could possibly fill it up with businesses instead. As far as the vision is concerned, I think it could absolutely be a beautiful city. I mean, I think we need to clean up some of the neighborhoods. We have, you know, our streets are cracked up, our sidewalks are cracked up. It seems like we're concentrating a little bit too much on the downtown and not allowing it to grow organically. So we're pumping a lot of money in there. We are putting in a circle on Mill Street down near Riverside Road. I actually found that it's going to cost us about $1.5 million. I mean, he's getting grants from the state and stuff like that. I understand that. But if I was the mayor, I'd be going for different grants and different funding. Stuff for the police department, because the police department is running more calls than ever. So they're super, super busy. And I believe they're a little bit underpaid, too. You know, in the charter, they get 2% raises every year. They're getting this year a 2.25% raise. For me, that's just not doing it. Basically, they're making a lot less money than Baltimore. And since our nickname is Little Baltimore, I think we should probably be getting similar, you know, salaries as Baltimore as far as the police are concerned.
You, on your website, you talk about this idea of transparent leadership. What do you mean by that?
I mean, when we hire, you can probably Google a lot of this information or by going to the city website and finding out a lot of information. But there are certain things that are not transparent in this city. And one of the obvious things are, and some people think this is frivolous to speak about, but we had almost 400 geese killed in our city park. They're euthanized. And Jake Day was asked what happened to the geese. And at first he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And then basically the USDA said that they did come in and kill them. And basically this is the phone number of where we got the order from. And it was City Hall. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's where the order came from. And now if you ask Jake Day what happened to the geese, it's just no comment. But simple things like that. But if you're going to be, you know, if you're not going to be truthful about something like that, what else are you not truthful about? And that's a very good question, because I have done a lot of research and I found out a lot of things he has not been truthful about, or he's just hiding. So,
such as? I mean, beyond geese, of course, but other things that...
Well, as far as like, well, he's doing this zero vision project. That's where he's putting all these circles in and the bump outs and stuff like that. I mean, I think there should be a little bit more transparent on how he's doing that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, he just released the fact that we had 153,000 people at the festival. Now he's using Wi-Fi meshing, which from what I hear and the research I've done is not very accurate. Now, if you really think about it, 153,000 people, and he told me it was unique visitors. Now, in Wicomico County, we only have 103,000 people. And in the entire Eastern Shore, we only have about, 450,000 people. So that means basically one-third of the entire Eastern Shore went to this festival, which lasts about 2 days. So it's almost unfathomable. And people are going to say, well, I met somebody from Alaska. I met somebody from North Carolina. Sure, you did. But you know what? How many people you need to to have from other states in different areas to get us to 153,000 unique people. Now, I have nothing against the festival. I went there. I had a lot of fun. But I don't think it's transparent of how many people went there. And the other thing is I have a Public Information Act in on, first of all, the geese. I want to know what happened to the geese, who ordered the geese, how much did it cost. Okay, the other thing I have a PIA in is last year's festival. I want to know how much it cost the taxpayers. And when I first put the PIA in, I got basically rubbish. Okay, because I just orally asked the guy to look it up. I thought I was just going to get the information and it would be no big deal. But from what I got, there was nothing there. So now I put in an official PIA after I called the city attorney. And basically, it should be in on the 16th because they have to supply it to you within 30 days. I doubt it'll probably be. I doubt I'll probably get it. I also have a PIA in on the bike lanes, which is a huge issue in Salisbury. Anybody who lives here knows there's a problem with the construction with the bike lanes. We do not have that many bikers in Salisbury. I did have a councilman say that, well, we're not a bike city yet. And I said to him, I was like, well, what are you going to do, force people to ride bikes? That doesn't make sense to me. You can't ask a 300-pound guy to ride a bike. It's just not right. And there's very little parking in downtown. And I know what he's doing. It's part of the way the new cities are supposed to be developed. I mean, you could actually look in last April's National Geographic magazine. You can actually see city planning, the future of city planning. And it seems like he's trying to push us in that direction. But we are not a wealthy city. And I want to get back to basics. You know, I want our people to be safe. That's the number one job of the mayor, is to keep my people safe. Okay? And I know of a lot of people. When I first ran for, before I actually decided to run for mayor, mm-hmm. I went around and I asked people real quickly, just giving you an answer, what would be the first thing you would fix in Salisbury? About 80% of the people said crime. 10% said transparency, and the other 10% said better jobs. Now, I think these are all interconnected, okay? It's going to be very difficult to bring, you know, excellent companies here. And because right now we're at a 12% livability rate for the entire country, which means that 87% of the people of the cities and towns of the city have a higher livability score than Salisbury. So it is an issue with the crime and the homelessness. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll talk further about the crime with you because I think you have that on my agenda.
Let me ask you before we leave the downtown, do you think that it was, in terms of the folk festival, let's start with that. Do you think that was a good idea to have the folk festival? I mean, I know the governor came down. I went the first year. I remember to
Don. It all depends on how much it cost us, mm-hmm. and how much business did it really, or how much revenue did it bring to the business owners in the downtown? Now that's obviously going to be a guesstimate, but realistically, it's the cost. I want to know how much it cost, and if it cost us millions of dollars, probably not. Now I know a lot of people are donating for the festival. And that kind of thing. He's even walking around with barrels asking people for donations during the festival. Right. And I know some of my friends, what they just said is, I already paid for it. And the person would be like, what do you mean? You already chipped in? And he goes, no, I paid for it with my taxes. So mm-hmm. why should I give you more money? It's supposed to be free. But mm-hmm. you still have someone walking around and asking for money, which to me, I just think that's insulting, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, he needs the money. He's asked the county for money. He signed a 3-year contract with this thing.
Right.
And the thing is, when we did research on it on the folk festivals, we found out small cities like us ended up getting burned and owed millions of dollars, you know, going forward after the festival left. So after doing that research, that's why I put the PIA in. I want to know how much this festival cost the city, the taxpayers.
What about his plans for redeveloping the downtown area? I mean, they're fairly ambitious. Is there something you like about any of it, or do you think there's an overreach? I mean, how would you approach that redevelopment? I think you talk about this, the concept of being organic in nature.
Right. Well, the last few mayors have all been trying to revitalize the city, and it seems like it hasn't worked. I do like the idea. You know, Main Street looks great, but I mean, it is costing us a lot of money. I don't see the businesses rushing here. He also gives free rent to companies. you know, for a year, and if the company, you know, if the business doesn't work out, they leave. So that's also taxpayer money also that's being wasted. When I say organically, I say people would want to come here. We're not going to sit there and say, you know, we got to give you this, give you that to come in here. Of course, I'd probably give tax breaks for a new company, but I don't think people are going to want to come here when we have so much crime and homelessness.
Well, let me ask you about, because I want to get to the crime thing. So, because one of the things that he talks about is this idea that, you have to build infrastructure in order for businesses to come. And he obviously also, by the way, talks about this idea that there are more businesses there are more corporate headquarters in downtown and so on. But his emphasis is on the idea of you have to build infrastructure in order to attract the businesses to come. Is that a...
I think he's right. And that's why if you read on my website, I actually would continue doing the infrastructure to make us ready. Because my plan is when I become mayor, I will clean up the crime. I will, you know, attack the issue of homelessness. We need a place. We need places for these homeless people to go. I know Bob Culver. He told me all the rehab places are filled. A lot of the places, and put it this way, not all of them are you know, addicts. And
right.
And so we need a place to put for these people to go. I actually sat down with about 20 business owners on Route 13 in that area of near the hospital, and they're very upset. They've been losing thousands of dollars because of the homeless people being around their businesses. Panhandlers are scaring customers away. You have some used auto dealers that they're showing up at work and they're sleeping in their cars, defecating on their back decks.
So what would you do about that?
I think we need a place to for them to live, to tell you the truth. And when they do get out of wherever they are, just say they are a drug addict and they go to rehab for 6 months or something like that, we have to give them a job or something. Otherwise, they're just going to be back on the street again, which is not going to be helpful to anybody, and it would be a waste of taxpayers' money also.
So what is the role then for government in doing that? I mean, I think you suggest at one point, I think in your website, you talk about providing some jobs even for some of them. What is the role for government, and how do we then deal with the expense as well?
Well, the jobs for some of them would probably be for the veterans. I think the vets need jobs. I'm not going to, you know, if somebody has a PTSD or something like that and his life is in shambles because of the war he was in Iraq or Afghanistan, I am totally 100% behind these people. I would give them housing. But when you have a 23-year-old on the street that is physically capable of working, he has to get his act together. That's what it really comes down to. And we'll supply that, you know, if he is an addict, we will give him the ability to clean up. But as I think everybody knows, is 9 out of 10 people that go to rehab for heroin fail in the long run. Because one of my best friends, her son died when he was 21 years old, and he went to rehab several times. Actually, the first rehab I actually helped her find for him, it was out in Utah, out in the desert, where if they run away, there's nowhere to go.
Right.
And within 3 months after being there a year, his senior year in high school, he started using again. And then finally, he went to rehab 2 more times. The third time, he went to rehab, his blood was clean, and then he decided to relapse. And that is a decision of his, to relapse because his blood is clean. He took the same amount of heroin that he normally took, and he died because his blood was clean.
Do you think we need to do more in terms of rehabilitation and addiction? I note that this is the month that you go purple, I think, in terms of...
Purple's tonight, yes, down at the amphitheater.
That's right. Do you think that we need to do more, and where would you find the resources to do it, particularly for the city?
This is such a national question. I would be asking for federal funding. Mm-hmm. That's where, I mean, state at the very least. I mean, but this is going on everywhere. It's not just going on here. So, and it seems like no one has an answer to this. I mean, you could ask, you know, a little guy like me that's looking to go for mayor of Salisbury, but you can go to probably mayors of large cities or senators or, you know, congressmen, or even go to our president, and they don't have an answer to this. So I don't know how these drugs are getting into our country. A lot of it's fentanyl.
Right.
And, you know, if you see it on TV, they're sitting there with a 2x2x2 box, and they're saying this is enough fentanyl to kill 20 million people.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, like marijuana where they have to send it in like these huge shipping containers to get some pot in here.
Let me ask you this. So I want to turn to crime. And aside from the great debate over statistics, what kind of approach would you take to dealing with crime that's, say, different than it is now?
Actually, I'd be a lot harder on crime. I don't believe in letting these guys go. I consider a heroin dealer a person that is basically, it's assault. I think it's assault. And if someone takes that drug and dies from it, I consider it manslaughter. Okay? I want to get the dealers off the street. There's a lot of theft going on in our city. A lot of it's going on because of, we do have a lot of poor in our city. 27% of the people in our city is living underneath the
poverty level.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, people are breaking into cars, and usually they're probably breaking into cars because it doesn't cost that much, I believe, to do heroin these days. I think it's like $10 to do a shot. So if they hit enough cars that have an open door, because they're not even breaking the windows, they're just looking for an open door and they're looking to go rummage through the console for change. So I would be very, very hard on crime. I think we need more police. I think we should be, I think the cops should be running up and down in neighborhoods more often to scare some of these people away. Because I speak to my neighbors all the time. They're afraid. They're afraid to go out at night. I don't think I've been at Royal Farms down on the end of Main Street and 13. Mm-hmm. For like the last 8 times, I've been approached by a panhandler of some type, asking me for cigarettes or money or what have you. And it's irritating, to tell you the truth. And a lot of the I've spoken to husbands who won't let their wife out after night, or their daughters, because they're in fear that they're going to get attacked or robbed. So the crime is pretty serious here, and it's kind of like I hate to say this, but it's kind of like what Trump says: the people that are left behind, I find to be the people that are not part of the college and not part of the downtown. And I'm one of those. It's the people that live around the city that seem to not be getting much help. And I think that we need to start, instead of beautifying parts of this downtown where we don't live, I think we need to start helping the neighborhoods. And one of my ideas was, and I really have to see if this is going to work, is when they pay their taxes, maybe we could take a certain percentage of that money, put it in escrow, and as the money builds up a little bit, they could do home improvements. Unfortunately, it's probably going to be the landlord that's doing that, because 75% of our city is rentals.
Right.
And the other problem that I see here is that I don't know why we have not rezoned our city. We keep talking about, and Jake keeps talking about this, as far as we need more home ownership. Mm-hmm. Why do we keep building these monster apartment complexes then, if we need more home ownership? Why don't we rezone those areas so we could build small homes that cost $100,000, maybe $140,000? That would make a lot more sense for home ownership, right? But the other issue is you can't buy a house if you're only making $12 an hour. It's not possible. And that's why we need better jobs here. And once the better jobs come in here and the economy starts getting better, the town's going to clean itself up organically, believe it or not, because the real estate's going to go up. The riffraff will probably move out, and we will have a better city with better people. Not saying that people aren't good now, but they are hardworking people, the people that are here, but they're only making $12, $13, $14 an hour because we're all retail. And all I see is when one retail place goes out of business, another one takes its place. And what I call that is just basically moving dollars around, you know, and it's kind of like okay, we got the food trucks that we have downtown that we're putting in. Okay, now those food trucks, they're basically going to be sharing that money with our local restaurants and the deli that's down there. So I just see us moving dollars around, and truthfully, I don't think the food trucks are going to do very well, so they're probably not going to be down there that often. I mean, considering that I'm from Long Island, I'm used to more thriving towns or more thriving cities. Well, New York City, of course, but I was not a New York City guy. I used to visit it maybe once or twice a year, and that was to go to Madison Square Garden to see a concert or a hockey game or something like that.
Right, right.
But I mean, from Huntington, where I live, they still call it Little Manhattan, because when you go down there, you could spend all day in Huntington Village and find something to do.
What do you say? I mean, when I talked to Jake when he announced, one of the things he talked about in terms of economics, obviously he talked about there was a number of jobs and so on that was added, and talking about this being the fastest growing city in Maryland. And when he looks at the, when he looks obviously at Salisbury, he sees a much different Salisbury, one in which is economically growing.
Well, everything's flowers to this guy. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have the statistics that from 2000 to 2010, we were bringing in over 800 people a year. So realistically, our growth has really slowed. We're only bringing in like 307 people on average a year, and a lot of that could be people that are related to the prisoners that are in ECI. They could be babies because our median age is going down. It's down to 27.8 years old, I believe. And a baby that's only 6 months old is going to pull that average down, obviously. So are we the fastest growing cities? Yes, maybe by borders. But as far as I know, is Hagerstown, greater Hagerstown is growing much, much quicker than us, and it's one of the fastest growing areas in the entire country. The only thing is you just can't call greater Hagerstown, you know, Hagerstown,
right?
You know, where you just have borders around it. So, right. And by the way, why is it so great that we're growing so fast? I mean, what's the big deal? I mean, I don't see us, you know, the economics going up, you know, being much better. From the research I've done, actually the home income has gone down from last year to this year. And when I speak to people in the other parts of the country, because I have friends in other parts of the country, they're saying the economy's going nuts. You know, this Trump economy is real. It is doing well. And it's not helping us, it seems. I don't know why, but it just doesn't seem to be helping us in Salisbury.
Let me just turn to one of the other things you talk about. You talked about the idea that obviously you're been a businessman and that you're going to run the city like a business. What do you mean by that? And I would make one observation, which is that government tends to be far different than owning your own business, because you got lots of constituencies, lots of people who can say no, as opposed to say being able to say, okay, this is what I want to do and this is how we're going to do it. What do you mean by running as a business?
Well, first of all, we have to watch our dollars. Okay, we're not going to be spending money on things that just don't make sense. I think Jake is putting money where we do not need it. Okay, I'll continue with your question, but I have other things to say about
that. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I want to make sure the people that are working underneath me are doing their job and actually aren't goofing off all day long. Like, you know, the perception of most government workers is they don't work. I'm going to make sure they're working. Now, I don't know what's going on in City Hall. I'm not there. I'm not the mayor. But I would make sure we are going to be as efficient as possible. Now, as dealing with the council, I know we have to work together. And I am running underneath a common sense platform. I think that we could work together and just work off common sense. Why put money here when we really need it over here? So it's really about prioritizing certain things in our city. Do we need to paint this wall, you know, put a mural up, which looks great and it's a beautiful thing, but I think most of my constituents would probably want their sidewalks fixed or the potholes taken out of their streets. Just little things like that. And, you know, it's down near, think about Fitzwater Street down there. It floods every single time we have a rain and it's high tide. It's absurd. And, you know, I was speaking to somebody yesterday who was actually a police officer, and he told me they used to dredge the river there every single year. His wife was telling him that. And she said, it wasn't that bad when it flooded. Now they have to put cones in the street and everything else because they have not been dredging it. And maybe the sewers are clogged. Has anybody even checked to see if the sewers are clogged? There's got to be a fix down there. I mean, how can you sit there and make something beautiful over here and then watch something flood over there? And in that Newtown area, you know, the neighborhoods are beat up. And what's going on with our rentals is rentals tend to be very hard on the homes. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have beautiful homes in Salisbury. I bought one of them. It was built in 1952. I mean, with the workmanship that are put into those homes is incredible. It's not like the homes that we make today. I mean, these things are going to be around for another 100 years, no problem, if they don't get destroyed. So, you know, we need to start identifying this rental issue. But the only way to identify it is crime, homelessness, getting our economy better. And then everything should start working together like Legos. Okay, but if you take any of those things out, it's going to be very difficult for the economy to get better. We need big companies here. We need another Dresser Wayne here. We need another Campbell's Soup. You know, right now all we have is Purdue.
So what moved you to decide that you wanted to run for political office? I'm assuming this is not something you contemplated in your earlier life. What motivates you?
I moved down here to semi-retire. I was still going to work.
Well, yeah.
And play golf a lot. Okay, but the one day I was on the Neighborhood Next Door website, and I was arguing with this guy called Jake Day. I did not know he was the mayor. And I'm arguing with this guy, and I'm sitting there going, and I'm Googling stuff, and I'm like, whoever this guy is, he's just lying, or he's fibbing the whole time. Mm-hmm. And then someone called a mayor, and I was like, really? I am arguing with the mayor of Salisbury. And I started noticing the guy wasn't being truthful to a lot of the people. And these are his fans that go to this website. You know, these are probably more liberal-leaning people. And when I started seeing how much the crime is bad here. We're the second most dangerous cities in Maryland. And there's no reason for that. There really is no reason for that. Why aren't we doing better in that area? I mean, we still have a very high crime rate. And when I saw that, I was like, why aren't we cleaning this up? And I was like, you know what? I'm going to put my hat in the ring because why not? I've taken money out of our economy in the past. Let's put a little bit more time into this city as a public service. I decided to stay here and buy a home here. I was here for two years staying in an apartment, and I really liked the people. And the demographics are very similar from where I came from, which is a mixed community, which I really like. You know, I didn't want to go to just, you know, straight white bread community type of situation. I do like the idea of the mixed neighborhoods and the mixed city. So, I think I could do a lot better job than Jake Day as far as running a business. You know, it's like an architect against a businessman. That's almost like what it was. I mean, he's got a city planning degree. I understand that, but it looks like he's looking way down the road as far as city planning. Like, you know, like a futuristic city. And I just don't think it works here. I think we have to stick to the basics. And don't get rid of our parking lots. We need those parking lots. I had a rally at the amphitheater.
Yeah.
Okay. And I purposely rented the amphitheater because I think it was a waste of money. Because we got a $500,000 grant. But anyway, I only had like 130 people at this rally. Because right. I'm just running. First time running. And they were having trouble finding parking. I had people walking up to me, and I was like, I don't know where to park. And I'm like, we only have 100 people here, and you can't find parking?
Right.
Now, what if we filled that thing up with 1,000 people?
Well, you know, that's politics. You gotta when you get your people together, you gotta figure out where everybody's going. We've been talking with Wayne King. He is running for mayor of Salisbury against the incumbent mayor, Jake Day. We appreciate, by the way, you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. In 2017, there were 19.7 million American adults who battled substance abuse in that year. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The numbers can be staggering. Opioid addiction has struck communities across the nation, even in rural areas once thought to be safe from the kind of epidemic seen in big urban areas. National Survey on Drug Use and Health found that 1 in 8 people have struggled with both alcohol and drug use problems. Meanwhile, the survey found that abuse and addiction cost American society more than $740 billion a year in workplace productivity, health care expenses, and crime. Take a look at the issue for this month. We have in our studio Vicki Lloyd. She's with the Somerset County Emergency Services. And also Mike Trader. He's with the Behavioral Health Services for Worcester County. And welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So let's just start with the fact that this is going purple month. Vicki, tell me what that means.
Well, Somerset reigns purple. We don't go purple. But no, it's definitely purple. Purple is the color that is used to represent opiate awareness. And September is all about opiate awareness and recovery and just getting out there and breaking stigmas and, you know, trying to bring people together with services that they might need, whether they're an addict or a family member or a loved one of an addict.
So what kind of things do you emphasize in a month like this?
There's a lot going on out there. Every county on the Eastern Shore is going purple this month. Mm-hmm. So for us, we were very active. We had a walk that started August 31st. We kicked it off with our walk, a walk of remembrance. We did both of the parades, the one in Crisfield on Labor Day and the one in Deal Island for the skipjack races. So we were right there with the public.
So, Mike, what does it mean for Worcester County?
Well, you know, Somerset being Recovery Month is just it's a time, I think, for all of us to stop and kind of pause and look at what's going on here, and to look at the folks who are suffering and the families of those who are suffering right along with them, and kind of pause and look at, you know, what can we do to kind of make sure that this is at the forefront of our minds and make sure that we as a community are really focusing on it and tackling it together. Just this past Saturday, there was a recovery walk on the boardwalk in Ocean City. Like she said, the entire Eastern Shore is going purple. And so it's really, it's a time to really bring awareness and bring, again, people's focus and try to get some extra resources and attention to this problem that needs the attention right now.
So Vicki, are you think that people are highly aware of this problem? I mean, we hear a lot about it. We've heard a lot about it in the news and the media and so on and so forth. How much are people aware of it in terms of general as opposed to their own personal situations?
I think that people sometimes, ignorance can be bliss. You don't really want to know that your neighbor or your friend or your loved one has an addiction problem. And so sometimes we dismiss it, oh, you know, they're this or they're that. And we don't always look out for everything that's going on around us, and we don't intervene quickly.
And we also have in our studio Debbie Smullen. She's coordinating events for
Worcester County.
Tell me a little bit about the kind of things that you guys have been planning and doing over this month.
Great. Thank you for having us today. We have done several events already. We had our kickoff at the Shorebird Stadium. We are doing several events where we're painting rocks, and that is a project that was sponsored by the Worcester County Arts Council. We're going to be painting rocks with messages of hope and inspiration. Once we get all the rocks painted, we're going to put them in a river of hope that will be located at the Atlantic Club in West Ocean City. We're going to have an open house on September the 26th from 5 to 8. To dedicate that river of hope. So we're hoping that a lot of community members come out. We've invited a lot of city and county officials to come out and support that mission.
So let me ask you, Mike, same question I asked Vicki, is how much do you think people are aware of this sort of in general, but when are they relating it to their own personal experience, do you think?
You know, I think some folks are. I think that we still see a lot of stigma out there. You know, so there are folks who have their personal experiences and their personal struggles. You know, and then there are some folks who it's not hit them quite as close to home. And I think, you know, there's some differences there in how the issue is perceived. And I think that's one of our battles as we're going purple and as we're really talking about it during Recovery Month is how do we combat that stigma and how do we get everybody on the same page and make sure that everybody really understands what a problem this is and that it's not, this isn't an issue that's affecting one class or one group of people. This is across the board. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are. It's hitting and it's hitting close to home. And, you know, for those who haven't been personally affected quite as closely, you know, odds are pretty good that you know, they're going to know someone, you know, and so it's a matter of how do we get there and how do we stop kind of put the brakes on this thing right now and start to kind of, you know, prevent future crises.
So, Vicki, how did we get here? What kind of history are we looking at in terms of now all of a sudden we seem to be aware of the fact that this is a growing problem?
The numbers for the overdoses and the deaths have really risen in the past few years. I think in 2016 they really spiked and it drew some attention. And then we started looking at it and started seeing where it was coming from. It's coming from a lot of different places. You know, some of it is just experimental and they move past that and they move into a life of drugs. Some of it is coming from, you know, a medical procedure, and they start taking medication and they end up getting addicted to them. And it just, it's amazing the different ways that people get into this. You know, it's, you can't say it's their fault. There's just so many different ways that it happens, and I don't think anyone's immune. Maybe you personally aren't going to be using the drugs, but you might be the one enabling somebody else to do it.
Mm. What about you, Mike? What
Absolutely. What, like Vicki said, I can't tell you the number of folks I've talked to who their journey with addictions began with something as simple as a dental procedure or a minor surgery, and they were then prescribed opiates, and their body became dependent on the opiates. You know, and that's kind of how they began. You know, everybody's journey is different. Certainly, we see a lot of folks who have backgrounds, trauma histories, who, you know, it led them to substance use down the road. You know, so everybody's journey into addictions is different. And I think on the flip side of that, I think that helps us to understand that everybody's journey into recovery is also going to be different. And so looking at what works for one person may not be the thing that works for someone else. So which I think is why it's so important that we come together as a community and we really look at what are the treatment resources out there, what are the recovery resources out there, is it AA, NA groups, what are the things that we can do to wrap around folks as a community and make sure that their needs are being met so that whatever it is that they need to reach recovery, they have available to them.
I mean, is it principally deriving out of the medical experience? A lot of people talk about that, as opposed to simply just the kind of illicit drugs that, for instance, were, say, developed in the 1960s and 70s, which obviously drugs became popular then. Is it more prescription issue, do you think?
You know, it's again, we're seeing a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both. And when you start talking about illicit drug use, what we're seeing now is very different than the types of illicit drugs that were out there in the 60s and 70s, much more potent. When we talk about opiate deaths, a lot of what we're seeing is fentanyl. You know, it's so, you know, where years ago, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there was heroin out there. There's now fentanyl and synthetics and things like that. We're also seeing fentanyl being laced into other drugs. We're seeing fentanyl laced into cocaine. I haven't seen it locally, but I know I've heard of fentanyl even being laced into marijuana and different. So you have folks who are going out thinking this is the thing that I've used historically, not realizing that what they're getting now is something that's much more dangerous and much more lethal.
So, Vicki, in terms of what we do about this, I mean, are there a lot of programs then that have a hands-on? I mean, one of the traditional, obviously, we were talking about before the show, the 1980s, there was a lot of emphasis on locking people up and so on. And the law sort of law enforcement approach to dealing with drugs. Obviously, this has changed. Are we seeing more trying to get away from the law enforcement dimension and trying to get people treatment, do you think?
I think we've come to the point that we've recognized, it's a disease, okay? It's something that has to be dealt with. And locking them up is not going to make that disease better. How did they get there in the first place? You know, do they have other issues going on that help them make that journey to where they are now? And if you don't address those, you're not going to get them out of that cycle.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Mike?
There is, you know, a lot of really interesting data coming out of, you know, if you look at it, you know, some European areas, Portugal, for example, at one point had a very, very high rate of overdose. They also had very high rates of things like HIV and things coming from intravenous drug use. And they, you know, some years ago, totally changed their tactics on the way they were treating it. They stopped treating it as a criminal problem and started taking folks and giving them opportunity to enroll in kind of rehab programs where they looked at job training and job placement. They looked at housing. And they really looked at how do we, rather than ostracizing folks from the community and making them criminals, how do we wrap our arms around folks and how do we bring them into the fold and make them feel connected? And there's a lot of data out there that's really showing that when folks feel more connected as part of a community and when they have sort of the ability to kind of build and create a new life, that's really where the recovery comes. There are some pilot programs going on in the U.S. right now that are doing this. I was just reading, I think it was Seattle, a couple weeks ago, is getting ready to pilot a program such as that. You know, and again, that's what the data is showing. And, You know, it's you know, for some of us, I think it's a little difficult because, you know, we've heard of it as a criminal problem and folks should be locked up and all of this. But the data is not lying. And, you know, the data is there that shows that if we want to turn this thing around, and both in a way that, that helps people, but also in a way you talked about the financial impact that it's taking. You know, there have been studies that have been done that have shown that the financial impact is lessened when we invest money into things that, that are helpful and that are kind of helping folks build new lives rather than incarceration. So it's a little bit, it's an interesting time to kind of see sort of this change in tactic, I think.
So what should one look for when it comes to whether or not, say, a relative has a problem with drugs or anything, substance abuse for that matter? What do you think?
So I think, you know, one of the big things I always tell people is look for changes. When you know someone and you've got that relationship and you kind of know what their baseline is, when you start seeing major changes, it's a sign that something's going on. And maybe it's substance related, maybe it's not. And you don't really know until you kind of invest some time and you sit down with them and you start having a conversation. You start looking what's going on here. You know, so there are things like that. When we talk about, I heard you talk about the financial impact on the workplace. And one of the things we've started is a program called Addictions in the Workplace, where we're going out, particularly into Ocean City and particularly into the hotel, motel, restaurant industries, and really trying to focus on doing some training for the owners and the managers there on what to watch for in their employees. And it's things like, you know, is there someone who's typically been punctual to work and now they're late a lot, or they're missing a lot of work, or they're showing up and they're extra fidgety and they just don't seem themselves. You know, are they oversleeping? Are they undersleeping? You know, again, looking kind of for those big changes in folks is a sign.
Is it particularly in the work environment? It would seem to me that, that people would might be reluctant to come forward to say that they have a problem, because if they have a problem, then likely they may not have a job. I mean, there's that overhang, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things we're also, the reason we're focusing on that industry is that the hospitality industry has shown extra high rates of substance use as compared to other industries. And so we're really trying to focus there and look at that. And to some extent, it's been kind of normalized. And we're not just talking opiates, but also thinking about alcohol use in the restaurant and bar industries. If you think about the rate of substance use in those industries, it is much higher than in the general population. And so part of it is we're outreaching to business owners and managers is not, again, let's not necessarily look at this as a form of punishment, but how do we remove that stigma and how do we help the folks and how do we kind of get them back on their feet? Because, you know, what we found is that a lot of the business owners and managers would rather have those employees turn around and become productive employees again, as opposed to, you know, getting rid of them and having to restart and retrain new folks and things like that.
As a matter of fact, we interviewed a chef some time back, and she talked about particularly her early days in which, mm-hmm. because of the hyperness of the job and the coming down after a very busy shift and so on and so forth, that it was a way to kind of like wind down from the job, as it were. So let me ask you about fentanyl. Because that seems to be a relatively new thing in terms of at least its spread. I assume it's been around for a long time. What's its origins here? Either one of you, it's fine with me, Mike.
I know fentanyl was created by the pharmaceutical companies as a pain medication. Fentanyl is 50. I believe it's 50 times more potent than heroin. The body metabolizes it in much the same way, but again, I believe it's 50 times more potent, you know, so it becomes that much more dangerous. You know, we've seen folks, you know, for years who, you know, things like pain patches and things like that, and definitely has some legitimate uses. I know one of the things that we saw are there were some prescribers who I think were even lost their licenses because of sort of over-prescribing and things of that nature. And what we're seeing right now is the medical community is really kind of clamping down and getting much more careful about how much are they giving and for how long are they giving it and things of that nature. You know, and so part of the turnaround that I feel like we're starting to see is due to the medical community and the local hospitals really stepping up and really changing again their tactics on how they're addressing things, looking at can we deal with the pain with other medications that are not opiate related, with other medications that are not as addictive. You know, so we're starting to see the medical community really jump on board. Not starting, they've been doing it for a while now, but the changes that they're making have been a huge step in the right direction.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, should ask because there's a number of settlements now going on with some of the pharmaceutical mm-hmm. companies. How much responsibility do you think they have or the medical establishment has for all of this? Were they just not looking? What's your sense about it?
That is an awfully big question.
and the answer is?
I think, certainly the pharmaceuticals are always trying to keep up with the need. And it's always, it's always looking for what's the better thing. Because when you have someone who is truly legitimately struggling with severe pain, you want there to be an answer for that. And folks want there to be a medication for that. The downside is I don't know that the pharmaceutical companies or that anyone really saw where this thing was headed or, how quickly, something like this would get out of control and to what degree.
I want to turn to you, Vicki, because we were talking earlier about kids, mm-hmm. about trying to get in early in terms of what they think about drugs, their perception of drugs. You described how you're trying to get them to move about and so on. What efforts are there made to try to get it? Maybe an early age to teach them, hey, this is not necessarily a good thing.
Well, back in my day.
We
had DARE, but right. That's not, it's still out there. It's just not as active in all locales as it was before. But you have to talk to the kids in different ways now. You have to find ways to reach them because very often there's so much going on with the peer pressure and with their friends and everything else. And sometimes there's a lot of absentee parenting. Or maybe even their parents are having problems with addiction. And so you have to try and reach these kids in so many different ways. Just, open up to them, make it a very safe place for them to talk. Teach them one step at a time, tiny little things, reward them. I mean, we reward them with purple candy, go figure.
Right.
But it works. I mean, they keep coming back and it's like, we have this spinning wheel that has questions on it. Mm-hmm. Can I answer another one? And they're just learning as they do it. So sometimes it's very simple things, but you are getting messages across.
And they're really receptive, you think?
They want the candy.
Well, maybe.
They are getting the answers right. So we know from when we started doing it to now, we've had to change the questions quite a few times just to stay ahead of them now.
Hmm. Mike, in terms of, people grew up, certainly in the last decade, thinking that drugs were okay. We certainly had the experience with many of them, and they grew up, and that particular generation still had a serious drug issue, but nonetheless, it seemed to disappear. Now this seems to be hitting a whole new generation. How aware do you think they are of what's going on around them and whether or not that maybe this is not a good idea?
The young folks, you mean?
Yeah.
I think they're pretty aware. But I think as I think most of us did as teenagers, there's this Superman complex, the idea that it won't happen to me.
Right.
I'll be okay. I know what I'm doing. I've got this. And so I think as adults, I think it becomes our job to really watch out for them and help them make right decisions and good choices. I think in addition to the education, there's also drug treatment. I know in Worcester County, we're trying to start it younger and younger. We've got a addictions counselors who go into all of the high schools throughout Worcester County and even into some of the middle schools. We're starting to see the use younger and younger. I think one of the other things that we can't miss is that that propensity for addiction, I think, in a lot of cases is born out of trauma histories. And so really looking at what are some of the other things that our young folks are facing and how are we dealing with that? Because if we focus only on the addiction, we're going to miss a lot of the issue there. So really looking at what are the things that our young folks are dealing with? How do we prevent trauma? And if different types of trauma do occur, how do we treat that? How do we get to the heart of that before it develops into something that we don't want it to?
What kinds of trauma are you talking about?
All sorts, really. You know, when we look at trauma, it's so important that we realize the trauma is from the person's perspective. And so, you know, one of the things that I do is I've done quite a bit of trauma therapy, and I'm certified in a model that works specifically with young folks with trauma issues. You know, and it's anything from sexual abuse and molestation, bullying, growing up in households where there's domestic violence, you know, any number of things, car accidents, you know, because when folks go through trauma, it changes, and you can look at brain scans and things like this. It biologically, physically changes the brain and the way that the brain operates. And, you know, when that happens, the brain starts to look for things in a different way, and it develops then that propensity for addiction to substances. Which is why, you know, again, I think it's so important that when a young person goes through trauma, whatever that trauma might be, that we're working to reverse that before the addiction really takes hold.
Vicki, you're on sort of the coordinating end of this thing with your emergency services thing. How difficult is it coordinating all this stuff or all whatever programs that you need? Because obviously you're working with the health department there.
Hand in hand with the health department. Sometimes it's difficult because we don't always know all the resources, although health has a lot of them. But there's always outside agencies, independents, United Way, all sort of, you know, coming up with different programs and things that are going on. So you're always looking for another opportunity to get another partner. We've partnered pretty heavy with Faith this year, the faith-based community, because they are a community upon themselves. And like, for them to bring, they want to do something and they want to take care of their own. So to have them as partners and teach them a few things that they can take out to their parishioners and share is really helpful. So, you know, and we have a very close connection with law enforcement, with EMS, right, with fire. So on the first responder side, we're hand in hand with them every day. So to bring all of these together has been really helpful.
So, Mike, if somebody finds that that somebody's in trouble, what should they be doing? And especially if somebody looks as if they may have even overdosed, for that matter. What's?
So there are a couple things. First, you know, if it's let me address if someone's not overdosed first.
Sure.
I think the best way to do is call 211. So 211 locally goes to the Life Crisis Center. They are the local call center for the 211 number. But if you dial 211, they have folks there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, who work to link you with the right resources. So if you're someone who's struggling, you can call 211, they'll help you out. If you have a loved one or a family member who's struggling, call 211, they'll help you out. They'll help you find recovery resources, treatment resources, whatever it is that the person might need. If someone is, you know, has overdosed, certainly calling 911, because the first thing you want to do is get emergency services there. You know, we're trying to teach everybody about the Good Samaritan law, because one of the things that folks get a little worried about is, you know, if I call 911 and law enforcement folks show up, am I going to get in trouble for this? So the Good Samaritan law protects against three different things. It protects against possession of a controlled dangerous substance. So if you're in possession, you will not get charged with that if you're calling to get someone help. Protects against possession or use of paraphernalia. And protects against providing alcohol to minors. So, you know, the message we really want to get out there is if someone has overdosed, call 911, get the help, and don't be afraid that you're going to get in trouble. One of the other things that folks can do is they can get trained in carry Narcan kits. So if you have a loved one who's struggling with opiate addiction, you can get yourself a Narcan kit. And the pharmacies have these available. Most insurance companies are now covering it. I can speak for Worcester County. Folks can go to www.decisionsmatter.org and check it out. We are doing Narcan trainings on the second and fourth Friday of every month, where folks can walk in. You get trained on how to recognize an overdose, what to do when someone is going through overdose, which gets into things similar to first aid, you know, and CPR types of things. And then how do you give the Narcan? And then we're actually sending them out with a Narcan kit, which is a nasal spray that is a sort of a fast acting counteractive to the opiate. So it buys you some time. is similar to an EpiPen. If someone's having an allergic reaction, to use the EpiPen buys you some time. So that's another thing that folks can do to kind of be ready and be prepared and be ready to help someone if they do encounter someone with who's experiencing an overdose.
By the way, and obviously that the governor, issued an emergency declaration about this issue. How helpful has the state been in terms of resources and coordination? Vicki, what about you? Have we seen anything from the state? I'm assuming we have.
They were actually down visiting about a month ago, and they've been to every county in the state looking to see what people are doing, what programs might be working, what sort of outreach is working, and to try and put together a plan so that we can all share our best practices. And, if somebody's missing something, then, hey, we've seen that this works with these situations. And, it's great because everybody's trying something different. Nobody really knows what works yet. We know some things that work, and they don't necessarily work for everyone. So to look at all of these different ways that people are getting out there and making this happen, it's a good resource. And they've also put a lot of grant money out there that's going directly into this.
Mike, what about you? What have you seen in Worcester County?
There is a good deal of funding coming down from the state. So the state is really trying to, the governor, in addition to the emergency proclamation, also created an opiate task force years ago now. But there's, one of the downsides is, I think we're all, we were playing catch up because this thing kind of smacked us in the face, and right. I don't think anyone was ready for it or expecting it. And so there's funding coming out now for things like Narcan and Narcan trainings. There's funding coming out there to help new MAT services. That's medication-assisted treatments specifically for opiate use. There's money out there for that. Peer support. Peer support's a new thing that everybody's kind of talking about and that we have here locally. We have peer support workers. Well, that's only funded currently through grant money. And the state's talking about making that some sort of a fee-for-service that would bill through insurance companies. But while they're working out, the state is funding peer support workers, which is just a fabulous thing. I mean, the idea that to have folks who are in recovery themselves to be able to come out and say things in a way that, that most of us can't come out and say, look, I know where you're at. I've been in a very similar place. This is how I got to recovery. Let me help you. And just really give folks hope at a time that they might not have much hope for themselves. So I think, I think the state is really trying to do some good things around this, and both at the state level and also at the local level.
Debbie, I want to turn to you just briefly, sort of wrapping things up here. So what kinds of things are you guys doing in terms of the Purple Month, and how can people get involved with the kind of activities that you got going
well,
there?
Well, with Worcester Goes Purple, and I also wanted to mention, too, that Wicomico County is also going purple as well. So what we've done is just reach out to the community, and the support really has been overwhelming as far as the number of people that are involved, businesses, civic organizations, county governments. So we're lighting buildings up purple. We have businesses that are having purple days where they dress in purple. Mm-hmm. So there's just a huge outpouring of support, and there also has been a huge support from the recovery community. In Worcester County, we're working closely with the Atlantic Club in West Ocean City. And so I think one of the things that I learned personally was that people in recovery are very serious and genuine about giving back to the community that they really have taken from. So they're interested in volunteering. We had a walk for recovery on the boardwalk in Ocean City on Saturday. We had over 200 walkers. So that is something that we're spreading the message, and that really was our main goal this year, was to get the education, the awareness, and to let people know really what's going on and to help really stop the stigma. It's been overwhelming for me to meet mothers who've lost children. I met someone on the boardwalk on Saturday. Her brother died less than a month ago of overdose. So just to be able to connect with those people and let them know that the community does care. We care about the families. We want to support the families as well as the people struggling with addiction.
Well, no doubt this will be an issue that will continue on, certainly beyond the month of September, and I appreciate you all stopping by. We've been talking with Vicki Lloyd. She's with the Somerset County Emergency Services. Also, Mike Trader. He's the Behavioral Health Services with Westchester County Health Department. Also, Debbie